indicates that the subject of microexpressions is not some fantasy. On the contrary, real doctors, researchers, and professionals in the field of human behavior have put countless hours into understanding microexpressions. As a social engineer, understanding microexpressions can go a long way toward protecting your clients and teaching them how to notice subtle hints of deception. If you are a social engineer or just a person interested in learning about microexpressions, I strongly suggest reading Dr. Ekman's books, especially Emotions Revealed and Unmasking the Face. He is truly the authority on this topic. The following sections describe the microexpressions in a simplistic format so you can see how you can use this later on as a social engineer. As mentioned earlier, Dr. Ekman labeled 6 main microexpressions, and later on added contempt to the list, making 7. The following sections cover these one by one. Anger. Anger is usually easier to spot than some other expressions. In anger, the lips become narrow and tense, the eyebrows slant downward and are pushed together. Then comes the most noticeable characteristic of anger, glare. Anger is a strong emotion and can trigger many other emotions along with it. Learning to see a specific microexpression can greatly enhance your understanding of people. To learn how to do so, Dr. Ekman recommends practicing that expression yourself. He says follow these steps. Pull your eyebrows down and together. Pretend you are trying to touch your nose with the inner parts of your eyebrows. While your brows are down, try to open your eyes wide without adjusting your brow position. Press your lips together tight. Don't pucker your lips, just tense them together. Glare. What emotion do you feel? The first time I did this, I was overwhelmed with anger. The following is a vital point to this chapter. If producing the facial expression can cause the emotion, that must mean that our facial movements can affect the emotions we feel, and maybe even the emotions of those around us. Mastering the ability to reproduce microexpressions will go a long way toward understanding the emotion behind them. When you can successfully reproduce and decode a microexpression, you can understand the emotion that is causing it. At that point, you can understand the mental state of the person you are dealing with, not only reproducing them on yourself, but also being able to see and read them in others can be helpful in controlling the outcome of your social engineering engagements. Disgust. Disgust is a strong emotion, usually in reaction to something you really do not like. This something does not always have to be a physical object. It can also be something that is based on a belief or feeling. A food that you truly hate can cause the feeling of disgust, which will trigger this expression. What is amazing is even in the absence of the actual smell or sight of the food, the thought of it can cause the same emotion. When I was a teenager, I went to Disney World with a few friends. I am not, and I mean not, a fan of roller coasters. After much prodding, I went on Space Mountain, an indoor roller coaster. About halfway through, I had determined that I really didn't mind roller coasters, when suddenly I was smeared with something very wet and chunky. I was then hit with an odor that I can only describe as stomach contents. Not only me, but many behind me had the same reaction, and none of us could hold back our lunch, so to speak. Before you knew it, a simultaneous puking splattered the glass of the Tomorrowland Transit Authority, a slow-moving observation ride that offers a peek into the actual Space Mountain ride on part of its journey. What is amazing is that people in the Tomorrowland ride who sat there slowly going around the park saw the after effects hit the glass as they rode through, and saw all the other riders getting physically ill, which made them also vomit. Yet, they didn't smell the odor or have physical contact with the puke from the roller coaster riders. Why? Disgust. And this is one reason that while hearing this story, you probably started to exhibit the expressions of disgust. Disgust is often characterized by the upper lip being raised to expose the teeth and a wrinkling of the nose. It may also result in both cheeks being raised when the nose is wrinkled up, as if trying to block the passage of the bad smell or thought into one's personal space. Disgust is one of those emotions, according to Dr. Ekman's research, that is in reaction to sight, smell, or even thought of something distasteful. From a social engineering standpoint, this emotion might not lead you down paths of success, but it can surely help you to see whether you are hitting the mark with your target or causing him or her to mentally shut down to your ideas. The odds are that if you cause disgust for any reason in your target, you've lost. If your appearance, smell, style, breath, or other aspect of your person can make a person feel disgust, then it will most likely close the door to success. You must be aware of what is acceptable and unacceptable to your targets. For example, if your audit is for a prestigious law firm and you have many piercings or tattoos, a very strong, negative emotion may rise in your target, which can close the door to your social engineering attempt. You must seriously consider your appearance when working on your pretext. If you happen to notice the strong, negative emotion of disgust in your target, then backing down and politely excusing yourself to rework your pretext or find a different path in may be a good idea. Contempt. Contempt is a very strong emotion that is often confused with disgust because it is so closely linked. Dr. Ekman didn't even include contempt in his first list of base emotions. In Dr. Ekman's book, Emotions Revealed, he says, "Contempt is only experienced about people or the actions of people, but not about tastes, smells, or touches." He then gave an example of eating calf brains, which might be disgusting to you as a thought and will trigger disgust, yet seeing someone eating them may trigger contempt for the person committing the act, not the act itself. The fact that contempt is directed at a person rather than an object is crucial to understanding the microexpressions that go along with it. Being able to see whether the person you are dealing with is feeling contempt can help you to pinpoint more closely the reason for his or her emotion. Contempt is distinguished by wrinkling the nose and raising the lip, but only on one side of the face, whereas disgust is the raising of the whole lip and the wrinkling of the nose. Contempt is often accompanied by anger, because the things that can cause contempt in a person can also trigger strong negative emotions. Contempt is one emotion you want to avoid triggering in anyone with whom you are dealing, especially if you are in a social engineering engagement. Fear is often confused with surprise because the two emotions cause similar muscular reactions in the face. Recently, while on a plane, I was about to write the section on happiness, but something amazing happened at the time that served as the impetus for writing this section on fear instead. I am not a short man, being 6'3", and not a small build either. While I sat on the plane with a few hours to kill, I thought I would take advantage of the time to work. Let me add that coach seats aren't what they used to be. As I sat with my laptop open, staring off into space, I pondered how to start the section I had intended to write. I soon realized I was meant to start writing about fear because the gentleman next to me pulled out a water bottle and took a swig, but I didn't see him recap the bottle. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw his bottle falling from his hands toward my keyboard. My instant reaction was easily identified as fear. My eyes opened wide. My eyebrows crunched together inward. My lips pulled together and out towards my ears. Of course, I didn't realize all this as it was happening, but afterward I was able to analyze what had happened and I knew I had felt fear. Then I analyzed the way I felt my face move and determined that if I repeated the expression, I felt the same emotion all over again. Try to see whether you can generate this emotion in yourself by following these steps. Raise your eyebrows as high as they will go. Drop your mouth open slightly and pull the corners of your lips back. If you can, pull your eyebrows together while raising them as high as you can. How did you feel? How about in your hands and arms and stomach? Did you notice any semblance of fear? If not, try the exercise again, but think back to a time when you were in a situation similar to my plane experience or a car in front of you screeching to a halt out of your control. See how you feel then. From a social engineering standpoint, fear is often used to cause people to react a certain way. Malicious social engineers use fear tactics to get an unsuspecting user to click a banner or give up a valuable piece of information. For example, malicious banners might claim, "Your computer is infected with a virus. Click here to get fixed now." These banners work against non-technical users who fear the virus and will click only to be infected at that point. One company I worked with was hit by a malicious social engineer who used fear to gain access to the building. Knowing that the CFO was out of town on an important business meeting and could not be disturbed, the social engineer went into the company as a tech support guy. He demanded access to the CFO's office, which was promptly denied. He then played this line. "Mr. Smith, your CFO called me and told me that while he was away at this meeting, I better come down and fix his email problem, and that if it is not fixed while he's gone, heads will roll." The secretary feared that if it didn't get fixed, she would be to blame. Would her boss really be angry? Could her job be at risk? Because she feared a negative outcome, the secretary let the phony tech support guy in. If he was a skilled social engineer, he may have been watching her facial expressions and noticing whether she exhibited signs of worry or anxiety, which are related to fear. He then could have played on these signs more and more, getting her to cave in to her fear. Fear can be a big motivator to do many things that you or your target would not normally consider. Surprise. As mentioned earlier, Dr. Ekman and many other psychologists in the area of microexpressions have concurred that surprise is closely linked to fear because of certain similarities. Even so, some marked differences exist, such as the directions the lips take and the way the eyes react. Try this exercise to show surprise. Raise your eyebrows, not in fear, but with the goal of widening your eyes as much as you can. Let your jaw unhinge and open slightly. After you get the expression down pat, try doing it quickly. I noticed I almost was forced to gasp in some air when I did it, causing me to feel something similar to surprise. Surprise can be good or bad. Hearing your daughter's first words, of course, is a good surprise. Or the surprise can be one of an event, statement, or question that you didn't expect that causes this response. If the surprise is positive, it can often cause a smile or a jovial response after the initial shock wears off. A social engineer can sometimes use surprise to open the target's door, so to speak. Following up with quick wit or a joke can quickly put the target at ease, causing the target to lower his or her guard. Sadness. Sadness is an overwhelming and strong emotion. Sadness is one of those emotions that we may feel ourselves when we see other people who are expressing this emotion. Some people can feel sadness just by seeing others who are sad, and even to the point of crying. To show you how easily you can feel sadness, try this exercise. Drop your mouth slightly. Pull the corners of your lips down. Hold your lips in place, and while doing that, try to raise your cheeks as if you are squinting. While maintaining that tension, look down and let your upper eyelids droop. most likely you will begin to feel sadness. When I first did this exercise, it was overwhelming for me. I instantly felt sad and found I had to control the length of time I performed it because it caused me to be sad for quite a while. Another aspect of sadness that makes it an amazing emotion is that it does not always have to display as agony or extreme grief. Sadness can be very subtle. Sadness can also be displayed in just one part of the face. Many people try to hide sadness by using a fake smile, or what I call stoic eyes, where they stare straight ahead, almost in a daze. But you can tell they are trying to control the emotion they are feeling. The eyes are one of the best indicators to reading sadness. The expression is often confused with tiredness and other emotions that can cause similar eye movements. Tying in the body language with what is read on the face can also help to determine if it is sadness or another emotion. This can be especially true if you are dealing with other cultures, particularly in cultures where much of the face is covered by clothing. In many Middle Eastern cultures where women cover much of their face, you may only be able to see the person's eyes. In these cases, it will be very important for the social engineer to also use body language to determine if what they are seeing is genuinely sadness. Sadness is often used in social engineering because it can trigger people to take an action such as donate money or give out information. You have probably seen it used in television commercials showing a very disadvantaged child. These children may be malnourished, poverty-stricken, and seemingly unloved. But for just a small donation, you can bring a smile to that child's face. The images of sad, crying, emaciated children will tug at your heartstrings. I am not suggesting that these commercials are malicious social engineering, just that they use social engineering to a degree by using an emotional trigger to get a reaction out of the target. Unfortunately, malicious social engineers often use this emotional trigger to obtain things from their targets. I once walked into a restaurant and overheard a young man telling a group of older folks who were leaving that he just ran out of gas on the highway and needed to get home because his wife was 9 months pregnant and had just walked a mile off the highway to use the phone to call his wife and wondered if they could give him $20. When I heard some of the story, I slowed down and made believe I was on a phone call to observe the rest. He told his tale and then backed it up with, "Look, if you give me your address, I will mail you a check for the $20. Concluding with, "I swear to God." The story had some elements in it that could elicit compassion, especially when his face showed concern, anxiety, and sadness. He didn't get $20. He was given $20 by each of the three people in that group. He said, "God bless you," a few times, and gave the group a few hugs and said he was going in to call his wife and tell her he was on the way home. He hugged them, and they left feeling as if they had done their good deed for the week. A few minutes later, as I'm eating my meal, I see him at the bar drinking a couple of fully paid-for drinks with his buddies. Mixing a sad story with some sad facial expressions, he had been able to manipulate the emotions of those around him. Happiness can have many facets to it, so many that I can probably make a chapter just on it, but that is not my focus. Dr. Ekman's books cover many excellent points about happiness and similar emotions and how they affect the person with the emotion and those around him or her. What I want to focus on are just a couple of aspects of happiness. Most importantly, the difference between a true smile and a fake smile. The true and the fake smile are an important aspect of human expressions to know how to read and, as a social engineer, to know how to reproduce. Has there been a time when you met someone who was very pleasant, but after you parted ways, your spouse or you yourself said, "That guy was a fake"? You might not have been able to identify the aspects of a true smile in your head, but something told you the person wasn't being real. In the late 1800s, a French neurologist, Duchenne de Boulogne, did some fascinating research into smiling. He was able to attach electrodes to a man's face and trigger the same muscular response in the face as a smile. Even though the man was using all the right muscles for smiling, De Bologna determined that the look of the man's face was still a fake smile. Why? When a person smiles for real, De Bologna indicates two muscles are triggered: the zygomaticus major muscle and the orbicularis oculi. Duchenne determined that the orbicularis oculi, or muscle around the eyes, cannot be triggered voluntarily, and that is what separates a real from a fake smile. Dr. Ekman's research concurs with Duchenne's, and although recent research indicates some can train themselves to think about triggering that smile, more often than not, a fake smile is all about the eyes. A real smile is broad with narrow eyes, raised cheeks, and pulled up lower eyelids. It has been said that a real smile involves the whole face, from the eyes to the mouth. When a person sees a real smile on another person's face, it can trigger that same emotion inside of them and cause them to smile. From a social engineering standpoint, knowing how to detect and also create a real smile is a valuable piece of information. A social engineer wants a target to be put at ease so as to have the greatest positive effect on the target. Social engineers in any form, whether they are salespeople, teachers, psychologists, or any other social engineer, often start off a conversation with a quick smile. Quickly, our brains analyze how we feel about that visual input given to us, and it can affect the rest of the interaction. A lot of information is packed into the preceding section, yet you may be wondering how social engineers can train themselves not only to see micro-expressions, but also how to use them. Training yourself to see micro-expressions. Hollywood often overstates the abilities of the characters that appear in movies and television. For example, in the new hit television show Lie to Me, based on Dr. Ekman's research, the main character, Dr. Lightman, can read micro-expressions with seemingly no effort. And what is seen more amazing is he usually can tell why the emotion is occurring. Yet in real life, much of the research done by those in the field, like Dr. Ekman, meant sitting in front of pre-recorded sessions and analyzing these sessions frame by frame. After many years of working on this task, he is probably able to notice, pick up, and analyze micro-expressions very quickly. In the 1970s, he did a research project where he identified some who had the natural ability to notice and correctly analyze micro-expressions. Because many of us might not fall into that natural ability category, we need a way to practice, train, and become proficient at performing, reading, and using micro-expressions. I can tell you what works for me. I read the methods on how a particular micro-expression is identified, then practice reproducing it using a mirror, comparing my expression to the notes from the professionals that describe how it is done. I usually have a picture that shows the emotion I'm working on because having something to mimic helps me. After I feel relatively good about reproducing the micro-expression, I focus on how it makes me feel, tweaking small areas until the muscular movements cause me to feel the matching emotions. I then scour the internet looking for pictures and try to identify the expressions in those pictures. Next, I record news or television shows and play certain parts in slow motion, with the sound off, to see if I can determine the emotion. Then, listen to the story to see if I was close. All this leads up to working with live subjects. I watch people interact with each other and try to identify the emotions they are feeling during their discussions. I try both with being able to hear the conversation and also without being able to. The reason I chose this path before trying to read micro-expressions in my own conversations is that I found that trying to do it in a live environment without having to also focus on making good conversation is easier. I just read the facial expressions and do not get confused by other sensory input. The preceding method is the one I used before I had the chance to meet Dr. Ekman and be introduced to his training methods. Of course, he has books that contain step-by-step instructions on recreating and reading these expressions. His books also include pictures showing the emotions as well as examples in the news that show those emotions. His book, Emotions Revealed, does this in a very professional format that is excellent for learning. In recent years, Dr. Ekman has developed and released training specifically for microexpressions. His website, www.paulekman.com, has three different types of training that have changed the way people can learn this powerful science. Ekman's training gives the user a lesson on each type of microexpression via video and text. The user can play the expression video to see how each part of the face is involved. After the user spends as much time as needed learning and watching the video sections, she can take a pretest. The pretest enables her to see how good she is at noticing microexpressions. When the user guesses at what microexpression is being displayed, she can get confirmation or correction. If correction is needed, then she can take additional education and training. After the user is confident in her abilities, she can take the real test. In the final exam, no correction is given. The user is shown a microexpression once for a brief 1/25th of a second, and then she must select what the microexpression is and then wait to be graded at the end. This type of training tool can take years off of your learning curve in becoming proficient at reading microexpressions. One caveat, Dr. Ekman, as well as his contemporaries, state that even though you may become proficient in reading microexpressions, a microexpression is limited. What does that mean? One of the tricks actors use to be able to successfully show proper emotion is to remember and focus on a time when they truly felt the emotion they need to portray. For example, a moment of happiness that produced a real smile. As mentioned earlier, making a real smile is very difficult to fake if you aren't truly feeling happy. But if you can bring up a memory when you felt that emotion, your muscles will remember and react. Therefore, although you can become proficient at reading the emotion, you cannot read the why behind it. The why is often lost to science. I had a friend who had some bad experiences as a child with a person who closely resembled a good friend of mine. When my friend would come around, she had strong emotional reactions. If you were to read her microexpressions, you would probably see fear, contempt, and then anger on her face. She did not hate my friend, but she hated the person in her memory who resembled my friend. This is a good point to remember when you are learning how to read microexpressions. The expression is linked to an emotion, but the expression doesn't tell you why the emotion is being displayed. I know when I first started learning about microexpressions and then became somewhat proficient at reading certain expressions, I felt like I was a mind reader. Although this is far from the truth, the caution is not to be assumptive. You may become very good at reading microexpressions. However, later sections discuss how to combine this skill with interrogation tactics, body language skills, and elicitation skills to not only figure out what targets are thinking, but also to lead them down the path you want. The question you still may have is, how can I use these skills as a social engineer? How social engineers use microexpressions. This whole section leads up to this. As fascinating as the research is, as amazing as the science is behind this psychology, how do you utilize microexpressions in a social engineer audit? And how do malicious social engineers use them? This section discusses two methods of how to use microexpressions in social engineering. The first method is using microexpressions to elicit or cause an emotion. And the second method is how to detect deceit. Let me start with the first method, using your own ME to cause an emotional response in others. I recently read a research paper that changed my view of ME and opened my eyes to a new area of research. Researchers Wen Li, Richard E. Zinnbarg, Stephen G. Boehm, and Ken A. Paller performed a study called Neural and Behavioral Evidence for Affecting Priming from Unconsciously Perceived Emotional Facial Expressions and the Influence of Trait Anxiety. That changes the face of microexpression usage in modern science. The researchers connected dozens of many EKGs to muscle points on their subjects' faces. The devices would register any muscular movements in their face and head. They then played videos for them that had 1/25th second flashes of microexpressions in frames. They found that in most every case, the subject's muscular movement would begin to mirror that which was embedded in the video. If it was fear or sadness, the subject's facial muscles would register those emotions. When interviewed about the emotion the subject was feeling, it was the emotion embedded in the video. To me, this groundbreaking research proves that a person can manipulate another person to a certain emotional state by displaying subtle hints of that emotion. I've started conducting some research into this from a security angle, and I am calling it neurolinguistic hacking, mainly because it takes much from microexpressions as well as neurolinguistic programming, discussed in the next section, and combines them to create these emotional states within a target. Imagine this scenario. A social engineer wants to walk into a company with a goal of getting the receptionist to insert a malicious USB key into the computer. His pretext is that he has a meeting with the HR manager, but on the way in, he spilled coffee over his last resume. He really needs this job, and to help, would she print him out another copy of the resume? This is a solid pretext that tugs on the receptionist's heartstrings and has worked for me in the past. Yet if the social engineer allows his own emotional state to run rampant, he might be showing signs of fear, which is linked to nervousness. That fear can translate to an uneasy feeling in the receptionist and failure or rejection of the request. Whereas if he were to control his emotions and flash subtle hints of sad microexpressions, which is closely linked with empathy, then he might have a very good chance at his request being honored. Recall the previous discussion of the commercials that encourage people to donate only a dollar a day to feed children in need. Before requesting money, before flashing a phone number and URL, before telling you that credit cards are accepted, many long images of very sad children flash across your TV screen. Those images of children in need and children in pain put your brain in the emotional state that is needed to comply with the request. Do those commercials work on everyone? No, of course not. But although not everyone donates, it will affect almost everyone's emotional state. That's how a social engineer can use ME to the fullest. Learning to exhibit the subtle hints of these ME can cause the neurons in your target's brain to mirror the emotional state they feel you are displaying, making your target more willing to comply with your request. This usage of ME can be malicious, so I want to take a moment to talk about mitigation. See also Chapter 9. Being aware of how ME can be used doesn't mean you need to start training everyone in your company to be an ME expert. What it does mean is that good security awareness training does need to occur. Even when requests are designed to make you desire to help, desire to save, desire to nurture, the security policy must take precedence. A simple, "I'm sorry, we cannot insert foreign USB keys into our computers, but 2 miles down the road is a FedEx Kinko's shop. You can print another resume there. Should I tell Mrs. Smith you'll be a few minutes late?" In this scenario, such a statement would have squashed the social engineer's plans, as well as given the target the feeling of being helpful. To utilize the power of ME, sometimes you have to combine it with other aspects of human behavior as well. The second method, how to detect deceit, describes how you can do this. The second method for using ME as a social engineer is in detecting deception. Wouldn't it be nice if you could ask a question and know whether the response was truth or not? This subject has been a source of heated debate among many professionals who claim that eye patterns, body language, facial expressions, or a combination of all the preceding can indicate truth or deception. While some do not believe this to be the case, others feel these can be used as an exact science. Although some truth may exist in each of those thoughts, how can you use microexpressions to detect deception? The answer to this question you might take into account more than just microexpressions because, as identified throughout this section, microexpressions are based on emotions and reactions to emotions. Keep this in mind while listening to this section, which analyzes some causes and effects. Four things can help you detect deceit in a target. Contradictions. Hesitation. Changes in behavior. Hand gestures. The following sections discuss these items in more detail. Contradictions. Contradictions are particularly tricky because they often can and do occur in factual accounts. I know in my case, I often forget details, and my wife will fill them in quickly. After I get a little hint here or there, I often can remember the full story. This doesn't mean that I am always lying at the beginning of a story or conversation, but I don't always remember all the details clearly enough to comment on them at first. Or I think I do remember the details, but I really don't. Even after I remember the details may be my version of reality, and not the way the story actually happened. This inadvertent dishonesty is important to consider when evaluating contradictions as a clue to lying. What a contradiction should do is prompt you to dig more. Watching the person's microexpressions while you question him about a contradiction is also helpful. For example, suppose you have developed a pretext as a visiting salesperson. You are going to try to gain physical access to the CEO to deliver a CD with a special offer. You know the CEO is very partial to a certain charity, so you developed the pretext around that. As you walk into the lobby, the front desk person says, "Sorry, he is not in. You can just leave it with me." You know that if you leave the CD, a greater chance exists that your malicious CD will never be used. You also feel he is in because you see his car in the parking lot. And you know today was a normal workday for him. With those facts in mind and without wanting to embarrass the front desk person, you say, "Oh, he's really not? I called the other day and asked when I could visit and was told today was a good day. Did I mix up my days?" If you've played your cards right, and your expressions are genuine, this can turn out two ways. She may hold steady and again say, "Sorry, he's not in." She may contradict herself, which can be a clue that she is not being truthful. "Let me check whether he's in or not." What? She went from a stern, "He is not in," to "let me check." That contradiction is enough to signal that you should dig more. What was her ME when she did that? Did she show shame or maybe some sadness at lying? Was she angry at being caught in a lie? Was she embarrassed that she was wrong and maybe confused? You cannot automatically assume she is lying because maybe she really didn't know, and when you rebutted, she decided to really find out. After she confirms whether he is in, you can choose to dig a little deeper and probe more to determine truthfulness if needed. Again, playing your card of "maybe I mixed up my days" and watching her facial expressions can be a good indicator of her truthfulness or not. If in your first go-round you saw any hints of anger, continuing to inquire can cause her to be more angry and embarrassed and end your interaction. At this point, you may want to ask something like, "If Mr. Smith isn't in right now and I really mixed up my days or times, when can I stop in to see him? What time is the best?" This type of question allows her to save face, as well as gives you another opportunity to read some facial expressions. If you didn't notice anger, but maybe saw she looked a little sad or embarrassed, then you might want to respond with empathy and understanding to open her up. I could have sworn that he said today was a good time to drop it off. But you know, my memory's bad. My wife tells me I'm getting Alzheimer's. I bought one of those smartphones, but I'll be darned if I can figure it out. I don't want to be a bother, but when can I just drop this off for him? I want to make sure it gets right into his hands. Be very observant of minor contradictions, as they can be key indicators in deceit and help you get your foot in the door. Hesitation. Similarly to contradiction, you can use someone's hesitation to detect a potential untruth. If you ask a question and the answer should have come quickly from the person, but he hesitates beforehand, it can be an indication that he was using time to fabricate an answer. For example, when my wife asks me how much my new electronic gadget costs, she knows I know the answer. A hesitation can mean either I am evaluating whether I want to answer truthfully, or I might just be remembering the price. When I get a progress report from my son's school that says he missed X number of days at school, and I only know about 2 or 3 valid absences, I ask him where the rest of these missed days are from. If his answer was, "Dad, don't you remember I had that doctor appointment, and then you kept me home that day to help you with that project?" Most likely, that is full-on truth, because it was quick and has facts in the response. However, if he hesitates and comes back with, "Wow, I don't know, maybe the report is wrong," then noting his micro-expression during his response is a good idea. Does it indicate anger, maybe it being caught, or sadness at the imagined punishment? Either way, it is time for me to investigate more and find out where he was those days. Another thing to look out for is a well-known hesitation tactic of repeating the question back to you as if asking for verification that the question is correct. Doing so allows for time to fabricate a response. The use of hesitation to detect deception is not an exact science, but it can be a good indicator. Some people just think before they speak. I'm from New York, so I speak fast. If someone speaks slower than me, it's not an indication of deceit. You must be able to use the ME to determine if someone is just slow at speaking or trying to fabricate a response. If the emotion does not match the question asked, then it might be worth looking into. Changes in behavior. During a discussion, the target may change his behavior every time a certain topic is brought up. Maybe you notice an expression change, or a shift in the way he sits, or a marked hesitation. All of these actions can indicate deceit. Whether these actions amount to deceit is not certain, but they should cause you to probe more on the topics being discussed in a way that does not alert suspicion. These behaviors can be signs that the person is using the time delays to generate a story, recall facts, or decide whether he wants to reveal those facts. Hand gestures. People often paint pictures with their hands using gestures. For example, someone may use his hands to show how big something is, how fast something was going, or show how many times something was said. Many professionals feel that when someone is being untruthful, he will touch or rub his face often. Some psychological connection exists between rubbing the face and generating a fabrication. Taking note of a change in the size, frequency, or duration of hand gestures during a conversation is important. In addition, you should watch facial expressions during gestures that can raise a flag in your mind. When you detect deceit, having a plan for how to respond is important and a good idea. In the earlier scenario with the front desk person and her out-of-the-office boss, calling her out on her lie would most likely have raised all sorts of red flags, embarrassing her and ruining any chances of success. If your pretext is someone with authority, like a manager or department supervisor, and you catch someone in a lie, you can then use that to your advantage by forgiving the person you are now owed a favor in return. But in the same scenario, if the position you are in is lower than the target, playing that card can be dangerous. The authority action would not fit the pretext of someone in a non-management position. What it boils down to simply is that as a social engineer auditor, you must learn to use a person's micro-expressions to determine whether he is presenting the truth and to determine whether you are affecting the target the way you want. In some cases, you can even use certain expressions to manipulate the target into a certain state of mind. Remember, micro-expressions alone are not enough to determine why an emotion is occurring. Determining that someone is angry or sad, for instance, doesn't tell you why that person is angry or sad. Be cautious when using micro-expressions to take into consideration all factors to determine, as closely as possible, the reason for the emotion. Malicious social engineers employ these tactics of using micro-expressions discussed in this section, but their goals are completely different from those of a social engineer doing an audit. They often don't care about the residual effect on the target. If damaging a person's belief system, psychological stability, or even job stability can lead the malicious social engineer to a payday, he will take that path. Earlier in this book, you heard about some scams that came up during the attacks in New York City after 9/11. People saw an opportunity to cash in on people's sympathy and the tragedy that occurred, and didn't seem to care whether their actions hurt others. Many came out of the shadows claiming to have family who were lost in those attacks. Some of these malicious people received money, gifts, sympathy, and even media attention, only for it to be discovered down the road that these stories were all false accounts. The malicious social engineer spends a lot of time learning about people and what makes them tick. This knowledge makes locating an acceptable target to attack easier. This section just scratched the surface of microexpressions. The work of many professionals in the field has filled volumes. Seek out training, become proficient in reading and using microexpressions, and you will see an increase in your communication abilities with others. In addition, this proficiency will enhance your ability to have success in your audits. Neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP. Neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, studies the structure of how humans think and experience the world. It is very controversial in itself because the structure of NLP does not lend itself to precise statistical formulas. Many scientists will argue or debate the principles of NLP due to this fact. But the structure does lead to models of how the principles work. From these models, techniques for quickly and effectively changing thoughts, behaviors, and beliefs that limit people have been developed. As stated in Wikipedia, neuro-linguistic programming is a model of interpersonal communication chiefly concerned with the relationship between successful patterns of behavior and the subjective experiences underlying them. And a system of alternative therapy based on this which seeks to educate people in self-awareness and effective communication and to change their patterns of mental and emotional behavior. This book is far from a self-help book, so although the principles in it can assist in changing deep-seated thought patterns and habits in yourself, its focus is on how you can use NLP to understand and then manipulate those around you. If you are unfamiliar with NLP, your first instinct may be to run to a computer and type the term into Google. I want to ask you not to do that just yet. You will find that similar to social engineering, what you will often find first are many videos and demonstrations that just seem very unrealistic, such as videos of someone touching another person's shoulder and changing that person's brain patterns to think brown is white or some such. These videos make out NLP to be some form of mysticism, and for those who are leery of these things, these types of videos discredit it. Instead, the following sections break NLP down into a few parts. Up next is a very brief history of NLP, which can help you understand that its roots are not with street magicians. Instead, it has deep psychological roots. The history of neuro-linguistic programming. Neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, was developed in the 1970s by Richard Bandler and John Grinder, with the guidance of Gregory Bateson. Its roots came from Bandler and Grinder's research into some of the most successful therapists of their time. From this initial research, they developed the code concepts of NLP. This early research led to the development of a meta-model, which recognizes the use of language patterns to influence change. Both Bandler and Grinder were students at the University of California and used principles of their research to develop a therapy model called the meta-model. After writing a few books based on this model, they began to refine the core principles that would become what we call NLP today. This included things like anchoring, swish pattern, reframing, belief change, nesting loops, chaining states, and submodalities applications. After graduating with degrees in psychology, Bandler and Grinder began hosting seminars and practice groups, which served as places for them to practice and test their newly discovered patterns while allowing them to transfer the skills to participants. During this period, a creative group of students and psychotherapists who formed around Grinder and Bandler made valuable contributions to NLP, helping refine NLP even more. In recent years, NLP became the new buzzword again for managers, driving rapid growth of trainers, classes, and experts. Without any regulating body, the field grew as everybody wanted to learn to control others, lie without getting caught, or solve all their psychological problems. Practitioners were not licensed, so each group taught its own form and concept of NLP and issued its own certification as experts. All of this is what led to NLP being viewed somewhat unfavorably. Despite its rocky history, the core foundation of NLP can enhance your abilities as a social engineer. The next section discusses some of the core codes of NLP so you can analyze them more deeply. Codes of Neuro-Linguistic Programming. In the early 1970s, NLP had a code comprised of the collective body of learning and investigation that generated the first books, and the term Neuro-Linguistic Programming. As time went on, John Grinder and others have continued to contribute to the field of NLP. The new code of NLP is an ethical and aesthetic framework for NLP development. New Code of NLP. NLP's original ideas were born in the 1970s. As time passed, John Grinder began to realize that much of the old code must change to be brought into modern times. He began working with Gregory Bateson and Judith Delozier and produced the new code that focused more on what the person thinks or believes will happen and changing that belief. Learning techniques for expanding your perceptions, overcoming old thought patterns, and changing habits all help in self-change. The new code focuses on the key concepts of states, conscious and unconscious relationships, and perceptual filters, all of these pointing to states of your mind and your perception of those mental states. These new concepts are meant to move NLP forward and help practitioners think about it in new ways. Many of these basic tenets from the new code are being taught now as part of the standard NLP courseware. The new code is best understood by reading Turtles All the Way Down by Grinder and Delozier. It's compiled from their seminar, Prerequisites to Personal Genius. In essence, the new code states that to make a change, the client must involve their unconscious mind. The new behavior must satisfy their original positive intention, and the change must occur internally at the state of mind rather than at the behavioral level. This new code suggests how NLP can create serious and drastic changes to a person's thinking. This is a key concept for social engineers because as you investigate and analyze the new code, you will begin to see how it can be used to manipulate others. Before doing that, though, you need to understand the scripts that the new code uses. Scripts in the new code. People tend to have common problems, so groups of scripts have been developed to help therapists use NLP in their practice. These scripts lead the participant through a series of thoughts that help guide the person to the desired end. Several good books on NLP scripts exist, with The Big Book of NLP Techniques, 200+ patterns and strategies of neuro-linguistic programming being highly recommended. An example of one script is an outline of how to increase your sales by getting someone to start talking about their dreams. Once you have them talking about certain goals or aspirations, you can posit your product or service as answering one of the needs to reach those goals. By positively building on your product as fitting a need they have, you give your potential sales brain a way to connect your product with positive ideas. If you take time to Google much of the information included here, you will see that NLP can take on a life of its own. You can take many angles and paths when studying NLP. Despite all the plethora of information out there, the question remains, how can a social engineer use NLP? How to use NLP as a social engineer. Many of the scripts and principles of NLP tend to lean toward hypnosis and similar avenues. Even though you will not use hypnosis to social engineer a target, you can use many of the principles of NLP as a social engineer. For example, NLP can teach you how to use your voice, language, and choice of words to guide people down the path you want. Voice in NLP. You can use your voice to inject commands into people just as you would use code to inject commands into an SQL database. The way you say things is where the injection occurs. This single moment of injection is framed within regular conversation. Sometimes how you say something is more important than what you say. NLP promotes the use of embedded commands to influence a target to think a certain way or to take a certain action. Also, using the tones of your voice to emphasize certain words in a sentence can cause a person's unconscious mind to focus on those words. For example, ask, "Don't you agree?" Instead of putting an upswing on the word agree, like you would normally at the end of a question, put a downswing to make the question more of a command. Another one I've heard used effectively is, "My customers usually do the things I say. Do you want to begin?" The way that sentence is used and surrounded by other statements can make this a very commanding statement. More on this in the next section. But this skill alone can change the way you interact with others. The principles for it are steeped in NLP. Sentence structure. In English, the sound of the person's voice at the end of a sentence indicates whether what is being said is a question, statement, or command. A person's voice goes up at the end of the sentence for questions. The voice stays the same through the end of the sentence in statements. And the voice lowers at the sentence close for commands. Try this exercise. When you ask a question such as, "Is that your dog?" your voice will rise at the end of that sentence. Yet you can embed subtle commands into sentences just by changing them to a downward point during the sentence, not at the end. Here are a few simple commands for you to practice. Notice how they have the command injected inside the sentence. Remember how clean your room looked last Christmas? The embedded command is "clean your room," which includes a time shift to a happier time. This is an example of a pleasant, painless injection. By now, you can see the benefits. This one starts with a low voice, then up to a normal tone, then back down for benefits. The higher my company goes in consulting, the more nice people like you we encounter. Implanting the "higher my company" with a pleasant comment has just increased your chance of being hired. Partly because of the play on words, "higher" sounds like "higher," thus what the listener hears is "hire my company." From a social engineering standpoint, you can form sentences when performing an audit over the phone to maximize the potential for success, such as, "This is Larry from tech support. We are giving all our reps new passwords. Your new password is..." The following are tips for using your voice in successful social engineering. Practice. You have to practice speaking in this manner so you don't sound like a teenage boy entering puberty. Your rising and falling tones can't sound canned. They must be subtle. Have careful sentence structure. Develop sentences that maximize your ability to accomplish your tasks. Don't go for the kill, so to speak. A command like, "Give me access to your server room now," is probably not going to work. But you can use these voice techniques to help a target be more open to the idea. Be realistic. Don't expect to speak and have people